appointment of Harry F. Byrd Jr. of Virginia from the U.S. Senate this year marks the end of an era in Virginia politics. The period began with the election of Byrd's father to the Virginia Senate in 1915. Harry F. Byrd Sr. went on to become governor of Virginia in 1926 and later a U.S. senator in 1933. His administration has been called the most significant in Virginia since the Civil War, and certainly the effects of the Byrd machine have been apparent in Virginia politics for a large part of this century. You're listening to Frankly Speaking, and I'm Helen Ackerman at George Mason University. With me today to talk about the significance of Byrd Sr. to Virginia is Dr. Robert Hawkes, George Mason Professor of History and Dean of the University's Division of Continuing Education. Dean Hawkes contributed a chapter on Harry F. Byrd Sr. to a recently published book, The Governors of Virginia, 1860 to 1978. Dr. Hawkes, speaking in general terms, why do you feel that Harry Byrd directed the most significant gubernatorial term in post-Civil War Virginia?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Harry Byrd's term was one of the most significant reform of state government and done with, I might say, the most unanimous approval of the General Assembly of any actions any governor has ever attempted to take. A number of governors prior to Byrd and since Byrd have seen the need for major overhaul of state government and have attempted to, but did not have the political skill to bring it off. In recent times, of course, Governor Mills Godwin has successfully carried out a reorganization, although not as extensive as Byrd's.
What was Byrd's secret? Why was he able to carry the General Assembly with him in that way?
I think Byrd was a good judge of the mood of the times and of the sense of the people, but even more importantly, and what many people don't realize about Senator Byrd, was that he consulted extensively with people throughout the state in private before he took a public position. In other words, he knew that he would have significant support prior to taking a stand or introducing a measure or trying to bring about a change.
So he was backing and winning horses in most cases. He was obviously quite a personality. Would you tell us a little bit about what you've learned about his early years?
Yes. He was a man who was raised in a family that in a measure had come upon hard times. Although his father had been Speaker of the House of Delegates in Virginia and ran his own little daily newspaper, the Winchester Star, the Byrd family had none of the prominence that it had had in colonial days with the William Byrd family and the home west over on the James. And Byrd hoped to restore his family to some of the social and economic and political prominence. As a 15-year-old, you know, he dropped out of school to take over his father's nearly bankrupt newspaper. From that lesson, of course, he learned that hard work, careful attention to economy, good business practices would pay off. And in that prosperous period of the 1900s, the 10s and 20s, he did what many men dream of. He became literally a self-made millionaire.
You made an interesting comment about his lack of education, however.
Yes, he was unusual in that he enjoyed the outdoors. In fact, even late in his life, he seemed to enjoy, after he had become the world's largest individual apple producer, he enjoyed working in the orchards himself and supervising the labor there. Now, this was as a much older man with a good financial security. He liked the outdoor type. He went hunting a lot. He liked duck hunting down on the bay. He never was comfortable in intellectual discussions and in that type of setting. And and his mind tended to take a rather narrow, focused in view of issues rather than the broad perspective of issues. He had, in a sense, the good common sense of the people of the valley. It was a sort of down-to-earth, earthy kind of thinking, no nonsense, no frills, the kind of thrift you and I think that our grandparents probably had.
Well, it sounds as though his no-frills thinking included education amongst a frill, because he certainly didn't seem to do too much for education.
Unfortunately, you're correct. His support to all levels of education in Virginia during his term as governor would certainly be called minimal. The increases were very meager, and he generally, I think, thought that people could acquire education themselves if they really wanted to, as he had done.
When you read about his platform today, it could be Ronald Reagan speaking. He's talking about less government interference, more government efficiency. These seem to be his themes. Yet he was a Democrat.
You're certainly correct. The Democratic Party in Virginia during the 20th century has, until recent times, been very conservative. You might say that they call themselves Democrats as a result of the accident of the Civil War being blamed on the Republican Party. For example, President Dwight Eisenhower used to comment that he wished the U.S. Senate were full of Byrds because he and Byrd had a very similar philosophy. Yes, I think Senator Byrd probably would have maintained golden silence and had voted for President Reagan. And had he been in the Senate today, I think on roll call votes, you would have found him in the president's camp.
How important do you think that his newspaper ties were to his success? In the period where he was running for office, newspapers would have been the prime media.
You're correct. I think Byrd, and I don't think it was done deliberately, but I think Byrd used every opportunity to the very maximum advantage. I think that's an example of what a wise and smart man he was, what a hard worker he was. By starting a newspaper, the Martinsburg, West Virginia paper, and taking over the Winchester paper, his father's, the Evening Star, he got to know and become friends with a network of publishers and editors around the state. And they viewed him as a very successful member of their own profession. And when he later became prominent in politics, both as a state senator and governor, they were his friends. And I think that did help promote his career. And I think he valued their opinions. And often, before formulating a position, would consult with editors and publishers around the state to get their feelings, and I might say he listened to those judgments.
Where was the real basis of his support?
The real basis of his support came, curiously enough, from the most rural areas of the state. From the valley, of course, his own home, and from that southern tier of the state I'll call South Side. But it ran all the way from Southwest Virginia to Tidewater, Virginia, along the very southern border of Virginia. Farm people did not expect or want many services from state government, certainly not if it meant higher taxes. And in that regard, Byrd was extremely popular with them.
What was Byrd's attitude to racial segregation?
Byrd certainly was a segregationist in the sense that he opposed equal or same accommodations for blacks and whites in public and private life. Byrd was, at least prior to the Brown decision in 1954 of the Supreme Court, Byrd was not like many of the other Southerner politicians whom I'd call demagogues, people like Cole Bleece of South Carolina, people like Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi. in that Byrd did not refer to race publicly. He did not make race an issue. He did not, in campaigns, campaign against equality for blacks. He kept his thoughts private with friends. In a sense, it's unfortunate for his career and reputation that he is so identified today with the policy of massive resistance, which actually he supported late in life, late in his career, as an old man.
Mm. You hear a lot about the Byrd machine, anybody who moves into Virginia. Do you think the Byrd machine still exists? And do you think it still has any power in Virginia politics?
No, I don't think the Byrd machine still exists. I think there are remnants of it today that are very powerful. I think that, for example, the fact recently that the Republican senatorial candidate for Senator Harry Byrd Jr.'s seat, Mr. Treble, was able to attract the support of most of those old remnants of the Byrd machine. It may have been that support that brought him the edge and enabled him to defeat his Democratic opponent, Mr. Davis. They were certainly both very able candidates, and they certainly both sought and courted those remnants of the Byrd machine. But I think urbanization, mass communications, the openness with which politics have been conducted today would make it very difficult for a machine to operate the way it did under Senator Byrd. I think the question we might ask, in a sense, is not whether and why it's gone, but isn't it amazing it lasted as long as it did?
That is true. It is very interesting to see that it did last that long. The word machine, in fact, has some very negative connotations. Was Byrd's machine like those that existed in Chicago and New York?
I think it differed in some regards. It was alike in some regards. Senator Byrd used to always like to say that it was simply leaders in the state of a similar, very conservative political philosophy. In a sense, it was. He consulted widely with friends who thought as he did. It was not like Chicago and other areas in that I don't think there was any scandal in terms of voter fraud or in terms of stuffing the ballot boxes. There was certainly a very minimum of graft and corruption in terms of misuse of public funds, misappropriation of fees, or paying off private contractors. The Byrd machine certainly was a clean machine in that regard. Where they, I think, stand guilty is that they certainly encouraged a small voter participation in Virginia. They certainly fully utilized the Southern mechanisms to reduce the vote, such as the poll tax, the understanding clause, the extended residency requirement, to such an extent that between 1900 and 1950, on the average, about 14% of Virginia's eligible electorate voted. That meant that with 7% of the eligible electorate, you could, in effect, win any election in Virginia. That in itself is undemocratic, I think.
Well, he obviously had quite a hold on Virginia politics for a long time. Dr. Hooks, I'd like to thank you for being with us today to talk about this very interesting figure in Virginia's history. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University. For information about our guest or this program, please call 703-323-2138. I'm Helen Ackerman at George Mason University, the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.